It is Saturday, April 28th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today, on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, followed by your questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we are taking your calls and questions of comments of technology, and in the first half of the show, we'll cover the news of the week.
Tomorrow evening at 6 p.m., tune in for the second hour of a Pacifica special responding to the shootings at Virginia Tech. The program focuses on youth and violence prevention with Frank Zimmering, author of American Youth Violence, and Tamara Duke, director of the Group Prevention for Youth Alive. That's tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. During the second half of the show today, we'll welcome you to join the conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, also contact us by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the room with me are geeks Miles Elam, Slacker Geek and student. Welcome, Miles.
Good morning.
And Ryder Brooks, technical account manager at Sco, welcome.
Hi,
Lyle. See, oh, you're on mic one. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Hi.
The mics are twisted, so welcome. Now, last week you sat in and decided that we're friendly enough for your voice to be joining us.
That's right.
Thank you so much for doing so. Well, let's go ahead and start with the news, and I'm going to start with you, Mr. Miles. What's up with Diebold?
Diebold is a company that is one of the primary vendors for election machines, electronic voting machines.
I would almost say that you could call them infamous company.
They are, especially on this show.
Yeah, I would say so.
During the 2006 election cycle, one of the big complaints was strange election results that were showing up in Ohio. What they had found after looking at it again was that they had two databases of results, and while they should have had the same number of votes tallied, they were showing different values.
Wasn't there some kind of report that we said that they blamed it on sun rays or something? It was something kind of...
No, that was a completely... That was in Europe.
Okay. So this is just the general concerns that we don't know what's going on inside the Diebold machines, and sometimes votes are such that numbers are off in a way that isn't possible for the actual people to be entering information.
Well, their engineers were saying, no, this is fine. We're just tabulating results. Okay. This is just how it's going to work
out. So what's the latest news?
People who are auditing it were saying, no, they should be the same result. How else would you be able to verify that everything was correct? Well, what they've also found is that the database used in these voting machines is built on Microsoft's JET database engine. To give you a point of context, the JET database engine is what was used for Microsoft Access.
Okay.
And Microsoft themselves have recommended that people not use the JET database engine.
How long is the if you don't mind, I'm going to call it Access database engine. Mm-hmm. So how long is the Microsoft recommended not using the Access database engine? Is this a new thing?
At least since they released its successor, MSDE 2000, Microsoft SQL Server Desktop Edition, which was the equivalent of what the JET database engine was before.
And you just said 2000?
Right. Whoa. So that was 6 years prior to the election, a better piece of software that was a plug-in replacement. No code would have had to been changed. You put in this new software, and they're talking through an ODBC database.
Does that engine cost more money per seat or something?
No, they're both free.
So why did Diebold do this, do you think?
That's a fine question. It could very well have been just this is what the programmer was used to, so they used it. But it does speak strongly to the issue of security and quality control.
Does this...
What was the problem with the old database?
The old JET database was handled... would only handle single threads or single accesses at a time very well. If you had more than one person trying to access at the same time, it was highly prone to corruption. And there were a lot of folks that ended up with having a corrupted database, even if they did serialize the connection. In other words, made everyone go in order. It was just, in general, not a very robust system. And it just seems odd to choose it when there's another one from Microsoft. In addition, there was another one released from Microsoft in 2005. But I could see there being being a year lead time that wouldn't have been enough time to switch over.
But six years is unforgivable.
Yeah, 6 years is.
All right. Well, thank you for that. That's a little depressing, of course, because that does tally a lot of our votes in our democracy. So let's do some good news about democracy. What's up with medical insurance, Ryder?
Well, the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. have recently just passed a banning discrimination for genetic profiling. Almost unanimously, I think there were three or four people in the House that voted against it.
That's a roaring success. Can you explain why this is necessary?
Well, basically, genetic analysis of people's DNA is to be able to determine kind of like what their genetic makeup, what kind of genetic abnormalities they might have, could be used against them. And some people are actually afraid to get profiled because they don't want to be discriminated against. Insurance companies, health insurance companies specifically, or employers could potentially say, well, you have potential for heart attacks in your genetic makeup, and we won't insure you because you're high risk.
Right. Yeah. Either we won't insure you or we won't insure you for anything that has to do with heart failures.
Yeah. Or any other genetic,
So this basically says you can't profile people that can't affect
their banning
your
discrimination
insurance
based
cost
on
system.
Genetics.
Yeah. Right. All right. Well, thank you very much for that story. I think that's a success for House Representatives.
And the president has support for it, and it should pass the Senate as well. So it looks like it'll go through.
Thank you, Renner. Earlier this week, I was listening to NPR and heard the story about potential cell phones potentially damaging bees and killing off bees. And it was a very quick mention, and I was like, that sounds paranoid, but what if that's the case? So today, right before us, of course, the news break, after Dr. Don mentioned that there's some mite in Hawaii that is affecting bees. So does anyone know if cell phones are actually killing bees?
So the study that was done saying that cell phones were hurting bees, not only was it debunked because there's another source for it. They saw it. No, it isn't that. It's this. But it was, in fact, fully debunked, saying, no, the electromagnetic radiation from cell phones does not disorient bees.
See, what I had heard in this quick, brief thing, and maybe it was not on NPR. I can't recall where it was. But what I'd heard is when a cell phone is put next to a hive, the bees do not return to their hive. Is that totally not true? Because if that were true, I would think, well, that's a concern.
But it was not a controlled experiment.
Okay, so there's no fact.
They tried doing that. Well, I mean, they did it, and that was the result. But it wasn't over a large sampling, a sufficient size of sampling, and it wasn't controlled. As in, did they change anything else when they placed the cell phone down? Did they,
did they stand there with a whole bunch of smoke?
Well, I'm assuming they didn't have outright fraud.
Right, right. Okay, well, I'd like to keep abreast on that story, but basically it looks like it's other causes.
But it was likely a predisposed bias against technology or cell phones specifically.
But we'll keep an open mind.
Sure.
All right. High-speed processors. Talking about, Ryder, this is for you, the frequencies doing unusual things. Can you tell us about GPS and...
Yeah, apparently there was a study released, Swedish Defense Research Agency, that indicated that there were particular frequencies common amongst CPUs that could actually disrupt or completely make GPS devices inoperable. Actually kind of a high range, 700 meters away from the source of the computers, could potentially disrupt car navigation systems or airplanes.
And the general idea is that... GPS is just like any carrier signal. There's a frequency which the information rides on, kind of like FM is 88.9 if it's listening to the main station at KUSP. Yeah. And that GPS frequency happens to be very close to some of the new processor speeds.
Yeah. The GPS frequency operates between 1 and 2 gigahertz, and CPUs definitely can fall in between that.
Yeah.
Actually can fall outside of that range as well. This survey had indicated particular CPUs from Intel, and it doesn't need to be specifically Intel. It's just the ones they tested. 1.7 gigahertz processors, 2.9, effectively 3.0 gigahertz and 2.2 gigahertz.
Okay, so this interesting thing to me is that It's very common. Okay, so most equipment that you buy for your home, you're buying a toaster or whatever, there's a lot of, if you look on the bottom, there's an FCC, complies with FCC regulations, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if these bands are restricted. I'm assuming they are because navigation is pretty important. So it's probably restricted bands. So technically, you shouldn't sell retail equipment that interferes with these frequencies. But at the same time, a processor is just one piece of a final product. It's mm-hmm. it's kind of, so the question is, if I sell a case that doesn't shield against this, do I need to be doing more warnings to the consumer? So there's a lot of issues here, but you should be able to shield it if you build a case correctly and put the processor inside that. Are all cases doing a good job of this? So it's a really interesting dilemma, a technical dilemma.
Well, processors are not technically broadcasting devices, so they're not really engineered to, there's no requirement to shield your computer.
Right.
Well, are the FCC regulations regarding
other statements that they may cause interference.
Yeah, I'd be curious to what Dell would be doing about this, of course, because they're selling complete systems, and those are plug and play to some degree. That situation, it seems to me that Dell should be selling machines that do not interfere with something crucial like that, a restricted band. Mm-hmm. But the question I have, and maybe that's the case, maybe that a good shielded case doesn't do this. The thing is, a lot of people are doing, building their own computers, and who knows, and I've got like plastic cases.
Well, the cases are fine. What comes into a problem mostly are also the gaming machines that have the plexiglass eyes, because those will not block electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
Those will leak a lot more than the ones that are complete aluminum or steel
case. And what about those cases when you got a processor just sitting on your desk or a machine running on your desk without any case? And that's how Sean works on his machine.
Right, or you have the case open.
Yeah. So I want to see this. I think it's a great study. But
it's not just computers. It can be also cell phones. Some cell phones can operate on frequencies that
high. Yeah, not just necessarily the transmitter, but the actual internal to inside the machine. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We'll keep a rest on that as well. Let's see. What else we got that sounds good to me? What's up with we haven't covered this much on Geek Speak, but net radio, there's been a lot of rules and regulation changes, and it looks to – the basic idea is that currently – the rules about broadcasting net radio, which is basically streaming radio, have been some degree loose, and there's copyright issues, concerns, and so legislation came about recently. Can you give us a little background on this, Miles?
Well, it wasn't legislation per se. It was the RIAA had basically said, here is the bill.
To whom?
To webcasters, to people who are streaming songs over the internet.
Is this showing up as like a lawsuit to each one of these people, or is it just how does that?
No, it's showing up that they were saying, okay, this is going to be the pricing cycle, and by the way, it's retroactive to 2006.
Mm-hmm. And the FCC is approving this?
Yes.
Okay.
And
this is this idea, this concept, and the FCC approving it kind of produced this hailstorm of net radio is dying, because if this happens, it effectively will shut down a whole bunch of people that are producing good radio.
Well, it would shut down basically everyone that was streaming music.
Potentially even KOSP streams. Is that true?
Right. It depends upon whether the music is controlled by the umbrella group of RIAA. I think for independent musicians label affiliation, then I would think it wouldn't be an issue. Right. I don't know. It would be wonderful if someone could correct me or answer on that one. But with regard to most music, it's going to be by someone who has a recording contract.
Sure.
And so their prices are going to be per song times per user.
Okay, and this would effectively really take down a lot of radio stations that are online. So have things changed recently?
Right. Representative Jay Inslee, a Democrat from Washington, and Representative Don Manzullo, Republican from Illinois, have put up what they call the Internet Radio Equality Act. And it doesn't aim to say, okay, you get a free pass. What it does do is say that you must charge a royalty that's equal to satellite radio. They were saying, here's another example. This is something that's similar. It shouldn't be any more than this.
And
they're putting a cap on it, basically.
And is that a large amount? I mean, the thing is, most of these streaming radio stations, online radio stations that don't have an affiliation of a FM station or in some affiliation with a large network like NPR, these independents, they're not making much money at all on these systems.
I believe the bill is set for a vote today.
Okay.
So the results aren't out yet.
There'll be a lot of talk about
that. But if passed, today's bill would set new rates at 7.5% of the webcaster's revenue. opposed to just an open-ended.
Good. So if they're not making much money, okay.
Right. If they get a lot of hits and they get a lot of advertisement revenue, then they'll have more money to pay out.
Right.
But, so it's a flat rate just like the satellite is. And although not as good a deal as terrestrial radio.
Gets. Right. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We'll keep on top of that. There's a lot of stories today that we go. We'll get back to that because, of course, technology changes a lot. But we're here every week. What's up with Google and AdWords, right?
Apparently, Google just discovered that scammers were using their AdWords service. It's basically advertising service, pay per click link. Basically, scammers were paying Google to advertise to their links that were taking users to malicious sites that would install keyloggers or other malware on their site and then redirect them to a legitimate site. So looked like nothing happened. They have caught it and have removed a bunch of them. So, but it's kind of a little scary.
Right. Just a quick background. What is a keylogger?
A keylogger is basically a software device that transparently connects to your computer, mostly PCs, and records basically all of your keyboard activity and anything that you type on your keyboard and can actually redirect it to a remote site over the network.
So that would be any usernames you typed in, any passwords, any credit card numbers.
Not a good thing.
Not a good
especially
thing
since
website addresses, and all they can see the order so they could very easily get your account info and stuff.
Right. So basically you'd be able to see that you went to your bank site, put in your password, then you were confirmed with some security, and basically it's a way of stealing people's information.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming this is a really bad process for Google. Google does not want to be sitting here and doing that. And, of course, these companies that are taking over people's machines, these people, these rogues, whatever, we're paying Google for this for this feature.
Which, oddly, is sort of it means that things are improving because they have to go to those levels of resorting to those levels to actually get people to go to their sites.
Or it's kind of scary that they're making so much money that they're able to make an investment and actually pay for per click.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends. You know, because the way AdWords works is it's based on the keyword, how popular the keyword is, how much you pay. So it depends on how much, what the popularity is, what they're clicking.
Right. Be, right. So. And these AdWords are the text links that say normally have Google logo next to them, and they're a link with a small paragraph, and they come up. A good example is on every time you do a Google search, but they also show up on
other people's
sites.
They're off to the right and onto the top of the Google search engines. They're pretty distinctive sponsored links. So.
And then also on other people's websites, a good way to make revenue for your blog or something is to ask Google to put their AdWords on your site, and then all the clicks, you get a percentage of that. And so
it improves their ranking, essentially, and their visibility on the
And it's pretty broad. I mean, there's a lot of these things out there. So it's scary that someone would kind of be in that system. And you feel relatively safe because it's sponsored by Google. All right, thank you for that update. Miles, I think we're going to do – I think we got one more, but let's go ahead and let you handle the Dell flash hard drives. We've been talking about new hard drives not being a hard drive but actually being just solid state.
I want to do the Nine Inch Nails story.
I'll let you do two of them. We got time.
Okay, Dell is releasing an option to replace the old clunky spinning hard drive with a solid state 32 gigabyte SanDisk flash hard drive. This meaning that it will use less power, most likely translating to longer battery times, and it will be more resistant to shock.
Really great for laptops.
Right,
low
really
power and can be pushed around.
It's a much smaller size. I mean, normally with a laptop nowadays, you're getting a minimum 120 gigs. This one's going to be 32 gigs, and it'll probably be more expensive, it is more expensive than the 120 gig drive.
Do you think that it's really is? Would you do it? I mean, you have a 40 gig drive in your computer. Dying, isn't it? Is that working?
Right, my hard drive is dying. Yes, it is working.
Okay.
It freed up some space, so it's able to have some sectors that aren't dead yet.
All right.
But if I had the money, sure, I might give it a shot. But then again, if I had the money, I'd do a lot of things.
Well, I hear they're a lot faster. I mean, because it's a strictly solid-state device.
Their transfer rate is faster, or it's actually their transfer rate's as fast as a server hard drive, so much faster than a laptop hard drive, but their seek times are
phenomenal. Right?
Yeah, are on par with slow RAM.
So I'm sorry, you're agreeing with Ryder. They are really amazing.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. That's why they're
Ryder's completely right. I should not have stuck my foot in my mouth.
But you pay for it. It's like, I think they're saying that's like a $500 increase in their laptop.
$550.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man, I'm not going to buy one. So that means if I wanted to put one in my laptop, I got to spend that kind of money.
Yes.
I mean, because you can get 120 gig hard drive at 72 RPMs for about $100. So that's a lot more expensive.
Which is going to 7200 RPM drives are going to suck up battery power a lot faster. Right. And
when we talk about the speed of a hard drive, we're talking about how fast the platter turns. The faster it turns, the faster access to the computer.
So a 7200 RPM drive is spinning 7200
revolutions per minute.
Yeah. But it burns up a lot more power because the motor has to be running things faster.
They're louder and hotter.
Yeah. I had one in my laptop for a while, and I definitely noticed a big increase. We have a regular listener, Steve, who had an iMac, and the iMacs have small drives in them, and they're 5400 RPM. And he got an external FireWire drive that was 72, it's like a server hard drive, and maybe it was even faster. And boot off of that, and it's a lot quicker machine. So the hard drive access speeds are very important, which means that this flash drive, which is faster in all accounts, is going to really speed up your performance.
Yeah, except when I was looking for, because it's a laptop, I guess I have different expectations of it. Mm-hmm. Battery power means more to me than raw speed. When I was looking online for replacement hard drives, I was looking for the 4200 RPM drives.
Really?
The even slower, because there is a noticeable difference.
But you're really patient, Miles. So you don't have screaming children. I don't have the time to wait for my drive.
All right. I would think adding more RAM to a laptop would make a bigger difference than putting in a faster hard drive. And I would say get the extra battery power.
Really? Especially if it's a $500 difference. Forget it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You said that you wanted to mention one more story.
Yes. Nine Inch Nails has released sources for for three tracks of their new album Year Zero in GarageBand format.
This is the music software.
Right. Music software for the Mac. Did they make a Windows version?
I think so.
It's just Mac, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've done this before.
This
where
means that all of the way that you build the song, all the different instruments are on their own tracks. You could remix it, theoretically.
Right.
Pull out
and
the drums
that's actually
and put your own
drums
in.
The point is that he's encouraging, or when I say he, I mean Trent Reznor, leader of Nine Inch Nails, wants people to remix it, to try things out. This isn't necessarily meaning that he wants people to do this for money. He wants to seed the artistic community. And what Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails have been doing in the last year have been at complete odds with the actions of the RIAA. For example, at a recent Nine Inch Nails concert, they seeded a bunch of Year Zero albums on CDR, so they look like pirated copies, and put them in different places like in the bathrooms or in concession areas and things like that for people to find them.
They
so that they would
BitTorrent as well.
Right, so that people would seed them, they would have a viral nature to them.
Uh-huh.
And what was funny was that the RIAA then started suing people for this leak, even though the leak was intentional, completely intentional. And so now this seems like just another level of, no, let's not try to restrict it. Let's make it more open. Let's try to seed the community. And having a sense of, confidence to say that, yes, I am good enough that I'm making this new stuff and I'm seeding the market that I will be considered a pioneer in this.
This is a concept, an idea of sharing music. This is a pretty fundamental concept of music. I mean,
right.
There are a lot of musicians.
Everybody's sitting around with
musicians.
The guitar.
Covers are
like
very
just
common
trying
thing.
Different things
sure.
out and fiddling with it, yeah.
And it makes sense in our easy a world that it's easy to share information to be able to do this like this. The question I have is, one of the questions that strikes me is, does Nine Inch Nails, do they really mix their music on GarageBand?
I would assume that they're doing something a bit more complex.
Okay.
But who knows?
Yeah. Well,
consumer technology gets closer and closer to what we consider professional quality.
Sure. There's not much difference. But there seems to be that if you want to make it available to everybody to edit and play, you better do it on a system that's not proprietary to Macintosh. And so you might as well release all the tracks as WAV files or whatever they are. If they're MIDI tracks, that's really interesting.
Right. I'm sure his studio in New Orleans is a lot higher quality than most people's microphones.
We'll see. All right. Thank you very much for that. You're listening to Geek Speak. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Make sure to stay with with KUSB after GeekSpeak this morning, 11 a.m., Castle College, our youth radio show.
And
you don't have anything to read in the middle, and I'm confusing you because I'm pointing at you. I'm so sorry, Miles. That's right. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Ryder Brooks and Miles Elam. Please join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free anywhere in California, 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. We can answer any questions you have today. We have some brain trust in the air room with me. Miles is very fluent in, I don't know, a lot of things. So is Ryder. So anything you'd like to call us about, please feel free to do so. The phone numbers again, 476-2800. Toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Well, while we're waiting for calls to come in, is there one more story we didn't get to, Miles or Ryder? One more story? One more news story? Because I've got somebody in Big Sur waiting. Okay, that's too long. We're going to have to take the call, which is good. From Big Sur, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hi, Jim. Sorry about that. Yes, what's your question today, Jim?
Okay, so I have all these photographic images, and I have purchased and have here in front of me Western Digital MyBook, external hard drive, 500 gigabytes. I have two of these, and then I have a hub, a USB hub that I was going to...
Okay, connect these two?
Right. Now, so my question is, when I hook these up, and I actually want to decide what I want to put on them.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to see a couple of icons on my my screen, right?
Right.
And so I click on one, I click on the other, they both come up, and somehow something is going to allow me to browse and select the files I want to drop on there. Is that correct?
What operating system are you on?
This is XP Pro.
Okay, so I'm just trying to get a visual image of what's going on. Yeah, basically it mounts as like a new hard drive. In Explorer, you can see your C drive and your D drive is normally your CD-ROM. This is going to show up as a few more letters, one for each of them.
Okay.
And then in Explorer, you should be able to see the contents of them. They might be blank when you first purchase them. And then what you'll do is you'll open two Explorer windows, and you'll find the files you want to put on them, and you'll drag them over to the hard drive.
Okay.
You can also do in Windows XP, you can also do a copy and paste of files. It's a little weird, but you basically select files with your cursor and do copy in the edit menu or control C, and then you go to the other location and you paste, and it will actually copy them over. Right. You'll see a little window.
Right.
So so that's how you use them. The one thing to note is that these drives are going to show up as two different icons. What you probably want to do is plug one in by itself, and you can do this while they're running and stuff. It's pretty friendly. And name it something, and then eject or unplug it and then put the other one in and name that something so that at least they have a different reference so you know what the heck, which one you're using.
I was going to put the same stuff on both of them.
You're doing a really good redundant backup thing.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I still would recommend making sure you can tell the difference between these two drives.
Okay.
Because sometimes you'll plug it in and one of them will be the E drive, and then sometimes they'll switch. And so they'll be different every time you plug them in potentially, and that could get confusing. So if you have some kind of name to them, every time you plug them in, they'll have a name, and that won't change.
Uh-huh.
One other thing to note, very common for these USB hubs to be what's called USB 1, which is a pretty slow interface speeds for hard drive transfers. You want to have USB 2 support. Your computer probably supports it. The hub might support it. It's also very important.
Both the hub supports it, and of course that's what it says on the box here, USB 2.
You'll probably get an error message, a warning message saying this is running at lower speeds if you don't connect to USB 2. But in any case, also these hubs, sometimes they don't come with a power adapter even though there's a spot for them.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a power adapter for it, like a little block that powers it? Because it's really, I think it's really important to have powered USB hub distribution. But that more comes in when you're plugging in cameras or flashcard readers that actually draw a bit of power. These hard drives, of course, are going to run on their own power.
Right.
In any case, great. I think you're set. It sounds like a really good backup solution. And of course, the idea here is that you're going to have three copies of all your data, but maybe just two. Maybe you'll erase it from your primary computer. So it looks like you're sitting pretty.
Well, I was going to also store my stuff on an online service, FTP stuff.
That's good. Do you trust the company?
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
That's why I have these hard drives.
Yeah, I think it's a good call. Thank you, Jim, for the call.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good luck. from Salinas. Paula, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hello, Paula. What's your question today?
I wanted a recommendation for a laptop. I've been looking at some Dells that are on sale and also a refurbished Toshiba through Costco, and I wondered what your recommendation was for reliability.
Geek's got an idea of reliability for laptops. Is your radio on?
No.
Okay.
But I am on a cell phone.
Oh, okay. Well, is that your only question? I think we'll answer it off air if it's okay.
Oh, that'd be fine. It's
okay,
for a desktop, not a laptop.
For a desktop. I'm so sorry. Desktop computer. Where to buy one, what's reliable, what to do. All right. We'll address that a little bit. Thank you for the call. You guys got some recommendations on buying computers?
Gosh, it's been a long time since I bought like a desktop that was like pre-built.
Yeah. We don't like build our own.
My recommendation would be if you're not that computer savvy, to buy it, either buy a Mac or – no, I just got to put that out there. Or buying from a smaller outfit rather than just a large superstore. Because if you have questions, a smaller outfit will be more likely to answer your questions and help you out. At least that's been my experience. When you get it from a large store where just a cookie cutter computer – and I find it to be a bit more impersonal. And
well, I think it depends on really what your priorities are when you're buying a desktop. A lot of people need the support, you know, they do need that. So it's a mixed bag. I'd say Dell's kind of taken a beating lately on support. HP.
Isn't that always kind of a fluid thing though? Like right now, get hit hard on complaints about support. They'll throw a whole bunch more money and time into it. Then it would be great. You never really know.
And then somebody else slips, yeah.
What about the idea of Dell support is over the phone, and if you bought from a local store, even though it might be a little higher expense, at least you have a person that you can go to. Is that important?
Well, the thing is, if the computer is working fine, everything will work fine. If something goes, it's not an issue where you buy
sure,
it from.
Sure.
And for the most part, computers are commodity parts, so they're all basically the same thing. With some minor variations and some styling.
To me, that would argue that you want really good support because...
Right, and that's the advantage of having the small local shop is that if anything goes wrong, you go down the street or you go 5 miles.
Now, when you say small local shop, what about like Fry's or something? A pretty big company, are they a good place to buy from, or is that frustration?
I don't know if it's changed, but most of the people I know that are not computer savvy hate Fry's.
Okay, so
with a passion.
This is
because
kind of,
they're not. You know,
right. This is, and this is kind of my instinct too, is not to recommend people to go to Fry's to buy a full computer. So. Where do you guys recommend people go? I mean, I am a little stuffed on this. I normally recommend Dell. And the reason is that I know that the Surface loop is going to be relatively good. But we have stories all the time about Dell's mess-ups. So it's kind of back and forth for me.
Well, if you want the cheapest option, then a mail order will probably be the cheapest.
And not even Dell. You just go to Google and click on their product search and just find a computer.
Well, Dell is actually pretty good, especially because if you go much cheaper than that online, you probably will be sacrificing the support line.
Okay, what's our official, the three of us, what's our official recommendation? Maybe Alex, you can join us too on this
Dell,
idea.
I think, is probably a good – I mean, it's nice that you can customize their servers online or your systems online. I would say the gotcha with Dell and HP is when you start dealing with all this integrated software that they include, a lot of it with ads. I've had some people complain that it's just too much. You know, there's so many icons and it conflicts with stuff that you might want to install on your system, and you can't tell them not to install it.
Wouldn't it be don't you think it's appropriate to look at a purchase of a computer, especially when it's a completely new thing in your life, that you purchase it with also the idea of a maintenance, because computers just, they slow down, they get viruses, there's a lot of issues, backup problems, your hard drive's going to fail eventually. I mean, the reason why we get so many calls is because computers are hard and complicated.
Right.
So doesn't it make sense to find a small company locally, invest, buy the machine from them and say, look, I also want some kind of service plan with you. I want some service that you guys can provide to me as much
as possible. And almost any computer vendor will provide that, will offer that as an option.
Yeah. And doesn't
what,
the local
what they
one
ultimately
make more sense?
Offer is questionable, though. I mean, they go, your reinstallation CD that comes with your laptop, why don't you use that? You know,
right, right.
You know, that's often the case with.
And that's why I was saying the local vendor, because I know whenever I'll try to avoid company names, but there's one in particular where someone was calling saying, oh, I have this problem. And they were pushing and pushing, trying to get her not to return her laptop. saying that, oh, it's these other problems, oh, it's this other thing, oh, tried reinstalling the from the CD and all that. And a lot of that would have been solved if she could just go down somewhere and talk to them. That's why I always push the local vendor.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about Dell is that they do, depending on how much you're willing to pay them for support, they can come to your house and fix it.
Really?
And place hardware. I know they do that on the server system. And I imagine that they could do that for desktops. If you
get that support, the extended support contract.
Another great way to go with getting a computer is if you, I feel this is mean because, of course, I do this for my friends. You find a geek that you're buddy up with and you get a relationship such that they help you out. Now, we, of course, I'll do that all. We help our friends and our family with computers. The one concern, of course, is that you're changing your relationship to be a friendly relationship to that of a service relationship. And, of course, geek expertise are valuable, so maybe you should pay. So I guess getting a contract right out makes sense. I mean, you do it. The other thing is, for cars, when you buy a new car, you go in and get updates. And you make sure it gets cleaned up and you make sure it gets checked. It's a general cost. So I think that's the recommendation we have. Yeah. Local business, small if is preferred. If you're really looking for the bottom breakdown price, buy online through a company like Dell. Mm-hmm. And don't buy the service plan, but it's going to cost you in the end. Is that good?
Yeah.
And she had the question of whether to buy new or buy refurbished.
Yeah.
I don't see a major difference between the two.
Yeah, I think you're right. That was Paula from Salinas. Good luck, Paula. Let's go ahead and go to John from Santa Cruz. John, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, John. Did I surprise you?
You surprised me. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question today?
My question is, I'm doing some research in some topic areas. I'm a researcher, and I want to know, I've heard that there's a way I can bring up like different news sites to program. I have a Mac 1039 operating system, so that these things appear on my desktop when I turn on the machine in the morning, or I can hit a button and I can bring up three or four sites.
So you want to have an RSS feed reader, or basically RSS feeds.
Sounds more like bookmarks than RSS feeds.
I don't know what that means.
We're kind of talking amongst ourselves.
See, I'm thinking there would be a dashboard.
Of course,
widget.
I got my bookmarks, but I want three or four sites to bring them up for that day's news in this area.
Okay, so you basically want a bookmark of multiple pages.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you use Firefox?
I do.
Okay. Then it's built in. Which
Safari
is really
cool. Actually does this.
Safari
as well.
Does it too.
Yes.
Okay. So what you do is you know about tabs.
Yes. And
so, okay. So you create your tabs. You load each one of them to the site you like, and then you you go up to preferences in Macintosh. It's under the Firefox name in the left hand corner next to the Apple. Go down to preferences, and then you just click on for the home page. You say use current tab set or use current page. I can't recall. And then and you save that, and it's going to save the entire. All the windows. And the way it does that actually is it puts the URLs with, I think, a semicolon as a separator.
Yeah.
What's confusing to you, Miles?
I'm thinking for what he's looking for. I mean, yes, that would work.
You want to get more technical on this. Well, first off, that's the way to do it. Pretty easy. You make a bookmark. It's multiple tabs.
Right.
Now, Miles is thinking that since you're doing news reading, there's a great system out there called RSS. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay. Well, we're going to go on and get more geeky if you want.
Good.
Miles, what's RSS and why would it be useful to John?
Well, when you're using in a browser, Firefox and Safari also support what are known as live bookmarks, or that's the Firefox term for it anyway, where you're making what's normally when you make a bookmark in your browser, you have a way to get back to that site again.
Yeah.
With live bookmarks, what you're doing is you're saving a feed that says what the stories are. So that when you click on it, instead of being a specific site, it's a list of all the current news stories. It's constantly changing. That's why it's called a live bookmark.
Interesting.
Another one would be using dashboard widgets. So I'm pretty sure there are dashboard widgets that do RSS feeds.
That's
and then that really would be a keystroke away, and you would have this listing
dedicated to
RSS feeds.
If you bookmark, if you click on the feed in Safari, for example, if you click on the feed link, which is the normally little icon, it looks like an orange icon with little speakers. If you click on that, you'll see a page that kind of looks just like the data. It's a little formatted, and it's up in the left hand, up in the top, it's going to say add this to your Safari RSS, basically. When you add that, it shows up as a bookmark as well, but if you go to the bookmark, every time Safari opens, you go to the bookmark and view the bookmark like you're going to click on it. Instead of showing just that, it shows a whole bunch of most recent stories with their titles. So it's a way to kind of quickly just read the stories. So that's one another option. Definitely, basically, going with Firefox or Safari, clicking on the RSS link will give you features that are built into the browser. Super. And then, of course, Miles is suggesting taking a look at dashboards since you're using a Mac and doing it that way as well. Good luck, and of course, you can take a look at our blog. I don't know if our RSS is working at geekspeak.org.
I will.
All right, thank you so much,
John. Thank you very much.
We are taking calls with questions and comments of technology. If you'd like to join the Geeks and ask us anything you'd like, please feel free to give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, that toll-free number is all over California, 1-800-655-5877. And if you're outside of California, you just don't want to hear your voice online, please feel free to give us an email. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
I just did a quick look up for dashboard widgets and RSS feeds.
Yeah.
And sure enough, apple.com/downloads/dashboard/news, which I'll post up later, has a list of dashboard widgets that are made specifically for getting, for example, the top stories from the BBC or from MSNBC.
Cool. So it's built in a dashboard, which means that then you'd go click on the dashboard for Mac users. It's the thing that always pops up when you don't mean it to. You've got one of those funky mouses. But in any case, it's this thing that kind of has plugins. It's always available, and that thing's going to load news stories and show you snippets
right.
before you start to read it.
The dashboard widgets are things where you can bring up a calendar or weather reports, stuff like that. So it seems like that would be a natural fit. For what and, he was asking for.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, thank you very much for that. We are taking questions and comments of technology. There's nobody waiting right now on the phones. You're welcome to call us and ask us anything you'd like. We will answer it. Maybe not correctly, but we'll definitely answer it. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll-free in California, 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. And just to really drown that in, if you call right now, you can talk to Ryder Brooks, Miles Elam, and myself, Lyle Troxell. Ask us anything you want as long as it's appropriate for public radio. And we'll do our best to help you out. 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Well, while we're waiting for what are some of the updates? Anybody checking email?
Something I want to point out since we're talking about technical news RSS feeds, there's a cool website called freshnews.org. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It's it basically compiles a bunch of current stories from popular technical news reporting services. And it's just a whole page of them. It's a lot of information. It gets very geeky. It goes O'Reilly, Linux, gadget sites, /dot, CNET, you name it.
It grabs all of them? And how does it decide which ones it's going to show?
I think it's the newest ones.
Okay.
You know, it lists about 10 for each of the sites. And
just a good summary.
Yeah, there are some newsreaders that will interleave them, just go whichever one's the newest and just, you know, merge them all together.
Totally.
So they look like one big news feed.
I believe it pulls some RSS feeds from each of the sites
and then
compiles them all together.
And there's a whole bunch of systems that do this. I mean, Google's homepage, if you make a Google account, for example, you can use your personalized homepage and you can load an RSS. And that's how I actually keep abreast of my friends' blogs, and I just have a few of them up there. So every time I go to Google to do a search down below, there's a few stories. If one is I haven't visited, I'll read it.
And we have an email.
You know, I looked at this email. Is this the one about laptops suggestions?
Yeah,
laptop do you have a good screen. Conclusion for this? Because we are taking calls, and I'd love to take calls. I think this might include another show, personally. What do you think?
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's go ahead and take some calls. We got Paula from Santa Cruz waiting. Oh, actually, sorry, Paula, just wait a little bit longer. Let's go to Steve in Santa Cruz. What's your question today, Steve?
Good morning, geeks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got a little problem on my OS 10.4.9. I've got a login item that I want to get to quit showing up when I log in. And, you know, I go into the system preferences, do the thing, click the little minus sign, and it won't go away.
So when you click the little minus in the user management in Macintosh OS 10, what happens? Does it say it's doing it, or does it give you an error message?
No, it just...
Is the minus sign grayed out?
Hang on, I'm going right there.
Yeah, go ahead and load it.
The minus sign looks grayed out.
What's happening is you need to authenticate yourself and unlock it. You notice that right below the minus sign, a little to the left is the lock symbol.
I did that.
So click that symbol.
Yep, I did it. I authenticated myself, and it still looks grayed out.
Is it now unlocked?
Yes.
Okay, now click on the user you want to delete. So you have to select them, and now push the minus sign. Problem solved?
No, the minus sign is still grayed out.
I thought we were done. I was so happy. I was like, we solved it.
No.
Well, as promised, we don't solve every problem. But any suggestion here?
Can you authenticate to a user that doesn't have permissions to delete the...
You can't. He used an authentication user. It's very possible that you're authenticating. Okay, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
So the user that you're authenticating to, meaning that you you put in a username and password, is that the one you're trying to delete?
Yes.
That won't work.
Well, no, I'm not trying to delete the user. I'm just trying to delete one of my own login items.
Okay. I got what you're saying.
It just... Now... You know what, I kind of clicked off of myself and then clicked back on.
Right.
And now the minus symbol is not grayed out, but it won't go. It doesn't seem to want to go away.
What's the thing you're trying to get rid of, if you don't mind sharing?
Well, actually, and it could be because it's a font management.
Huh. Did you install this?
I installed a new font management system. So I need to get, I didn't want to totally throw the other one out. I just want to get it to not automatically.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you need to get the install disk of the original font thing and run that. Another thing you can do is the startup items are actually inside your library folder, probably in the root computer library folder. If you go in there, there's a folder called startup items, and you can actually drag it out of there. Now, it won't stop it from running. Then you'll have to reboot. That's one way to do it. Make sure you do not delete these things because you might need them. But that's a way to manually do it.
Okay.
And you might run into a permissions thing when you try to move it, and it tries to set up another permission. So that might be one of the issues. If you run into these permission issues on Macs, the great thing to do is go into Applications, into Utilities, and run a thing called Desktop Desk Utilities, Desk Admin, some disk.
Yeah, and redo the permissions.
And fix the permissions, and then you can do it. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Well, we wanted calls, and we got them. From Santa Cruz, Pauly, welcome to GeekSpeak. Pauly? Hi, what's your question today?
I have a laptop, a Mac laptop, and I have a little cabin in the woods. And it's powered with solar panels and batteries and an inverter.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a modified sine wave inverter.
Okay.
And when we bought it, it said, do not use this with laptops.
Did you follow their advice, or are you wondering if you shouldn't?
Well, I'm wondering if I should follow their advice. I actually did some searching on the internet and found out that maybe Macintoshes are okay with modified sine wave inverters.
You know, what they're doing is they're not producing a really clean signal, and they don't want to take the lawsuits of your laptop getting hurt.
But so what's going to happen? I mean, is it going to be...
It could fry the power supply
input. So if something bad happens, it's going to happen immediately? It's not going to happen over time?
No, either. It might happen immediately, it might happen over time.
Okay.
What I would recommend doing, it's not a very expensive fix. This is pretty easy to do. You go down and you get a UPS, just a standard off-the-shelf UPS, and you can get a cheap one, like a smallest one. And basically what this is another battery, and the idea behind these is you plug them into homes that are actually on the grid, and when you lose power, you have a little time to shut your computer down. It's pretty common in server environments, and we run them all, geeks normally run them pretty commonly because we have machines that stay on a lot. And the general idea is it's a small battery backup solution. The cool thing about this is this guy's output is very clean power, and it regulates your power. So it's...
Oh, UPS. It's an uninterruptible power source. Is that what it is?
Yes. Power supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we recommend them for using your computers in general, because even if you have a lightning storm, you get relatively safe power. It's a possibility of losing it. But the cool thing is that if you do fry something, you're frying that instead of your laptop, which is normally more expensive. So the great thing in your situation is you plug this into your power supply. Now, when you first plug it into your system, what's going to happen is this thing has a battery in it. It has to charge the battery. It's going to use a lot of power just to charge, and it's actually going to drain from your main power since you're on grid. So what I would do is go to a friend's house to plug this in the first time and charge it up, and then take it back to your house and plug it in. And then just anything that you're really sensitive about, like your laptop, use this thing's power output rather than your straight battery power inverter.
So you're plugging the UPS into the inverter and then the laptop into the UPS.
Right. And any UPS is going to work. The big company is red logo.
APC.
APC. But really any of them are going to work pretty well for you. Just go down to a reputable electronics store and ask for a UPS and take a look what they are.
Great.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And for a laptop, you can get the very cheapest one, smallest battery possible. Because what you're looking for is just a clean signal rather than a battery backup.
Because
the laptop has a battery backup.
Oh, there's one right there.
One right there, yeah.
So that's a back UPS 280. 280. That would work for you.
So that was at 280 amps or watts?
Who knows? We'll look it up some of the time. One more call today from Carmel Valley. Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak. Maybe we'll get two more calls. Steve, what's your question?
Steve, hi.
Hi.
So I just want to be able to manipulate or just move digital images from, like, my SD card to, like, a hard drive. And then
great, okay.
Put them in different files in the hard drive. And then, you know, from there to a disk, to the net, to paper, you know, from any one of those places to any one of the other places.
You're looking to manage
photos. Is there some software that makes it really easy?
Yeah. What operating system are you on?
I am on Windows.
Okay. On a Windows application, I am, in fact, everybody's operating systems now. I highly recommend Lightroom. It's a really wonderful application, but it's expensive. So that's a paid-for Adobe application. A great free one, which people say they just love, is Google's Picasso.
Yeah.
Either of you using Picasso?
Yeah, I do.
And what do you think, Ryder? Is that a good solution?
It's awesome.
Does it prompt when you plug in a digital camera with photos on it? Does it prompt and say, and it just handles it for you?
It basically takes you to an import thing, and then you import everything. It has duplication detection. It will basically integrate it into your preset folders.
It does a search first to find all your photos.
It's not the best in terms of file management because it has its own sort of organizational structure, which is sort of obfuscated from the actual file.
Is it one of those things if you use it solely, you're totally set? But then if you want to do it
yourself. It's compatible with other things. Mm-hmm. It basically auto-detects changes. Okay. And anytime you add new files, even if you don't go through it, it has an agent that watches it.
So for a paid application, when you're like really into digital photography like I am, Lightroom, I think, is the best thing on the market right now. There's a lot of other ones, mm-hmm. and I could get into it, but it's a whole show. And for a free solution, which I think would solve most people's issues with photo management, Picasa by mm-hmm. Google. You just go to google.com and click on more services or something. There's a whole page, and one of them will be Picasa. Thank you so much for the call.
Thanks.
And Alex supports your suggestion, Ryder. Alex from Los Angeles, who joins us via chat to support us and make sure we're not speaking ridiculously, suggests that Picasa is great. It's the iPhoto for Windows. And that's the other thing to mention. If you're on a Macintosh, just use iPhoto because that's built in. Let's see if we can take one more call today. No, we better not. It's too risky. So, I feel like we should.
Give it a shot. If we can't answer it, we'll apologize.
Bella from Santa Clara, what's your question today? Hello, Bella? Oh, let me slide the thing up that actually she's behind. Bella, what's
Hello?
Your question? Yes, hi. What's your question today?
Yes. I've got a question. I'm in the market for a new router, and in the alphabet soup of routers, I know N is still in draft, but should I go for an N?
What do you think, guys? New router, wireless, N?
So I thought N was ratified. It's still pre?
It's almost. I think it's 100%. Yeah.
People are accepting them. I mean, people are selling them.
Yeah. Well, what's your priority? I mean, do you want speed? Do you want range?
Range.
N would probably be good for range. It has the highest range.
Now, what about for speed?
Again.
The question I have for you, do you have currently a wireless card in your computer?
Yeah.
And N won't work with it. So, I mean, you have to update both things.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But an N1 will be backwards compatible with what you currently have.
Yeah, but so, you won't get the full range out of what the N spec offers.
Unless I have an N card.
Exactly.
Yes, right. And in fact, you'll see no benefit at all from the new routers in technology until you do get a card.
Recommendations on the manufacturer?
Don't have any.
Okay.
It's been a couple of months since I looked at it, but Belkin was actually at the time pretty good for a very popular N-Draft wireless router.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
To everyone that called into GeekSpeak today, thank you so much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We had Ryder Brooks the first time on GeekSpeak, but he's going to be a regular, right?
Sure.
Yay, Ryder. Yeah. And we also have Miles Elam. Answering the phone is Rick Philman. Miles, you think you got something to read?
Yes, I do.
Please feel free.
This week on This American Life, we rerun an episode that just won the Peabody Award. We hear from men who were detained at Guantanamo Bay, including two brothers who were thrown in Guantanamo for telling a joke. That's Habeas Schmabeas. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.